From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College.
This is War News Radio.
The White House announced today that the U.S. is preparing to accept at least 10,000 Syrian refugees next year. That will be a big increase over the 1,500 who've been allowed to come over the past 4 years.
There is a lot of uneasiness about the resettlement program that the president is trying to accomplish here. The president is, you know, kind of brushed away those concerns and said, it doesn't matter. I want, you know, us to admit as many as possible. And it seems like he's trying to get as many of them admitted as he can before the buzzer sounds on the end of his administration.
President Obama, Secretary Kerry, and most Democrats want to let in tens of thousands of Syrian refugees. They say, don't worry, America, we'll vet them. Really? Because there are no records or databases to tap into to vet these Syrians. In fact, we have no idea who these people are.
This is War News Radio. I'm Leo Elliott. Last fall, President Obama announced that the U.S. would resettle 10,000 refugees from the Syrian conflict over the course of 2016. You've just heard some of the ways that Western media outlets have discussed this commitment. If you have been following these stories, none of this should sound too unfamiliar. The Obama administration's decision has been met with questions about national security, about multiculturalism, and about how much responsibility the U.S. has to victims of the Syrian crisis. As a society, we have had a harder time answering questions about the refugees themselves. Who are these people who are coming to the U.S.? What kinds of lives did they live before the Syrian conflict brought chaos and displacement? What challenges do they experience on their journeys from their homes? And what new challenges face them once they arrive in the U.S.? These are the questions that War News Radio wants to answer in Narrow Passages, our series on the Syrian refugee crisis and the U.S. resettlement process.
For this first piece in the series, we want to investigate the U.S. refugee resettlement process from the perspective of the nonprofit organizations that serve as the first point of contact for refugees when they arrive in the States. These organizations offer critical social and legal services, ranging from language classes to job training to representation in court, and work closely with municipal, state, and federal agencies that oversee the resettlement process. We spoke with staff at two such organizations in Philadelphia, the Nationality Services Center and Hyatt, Pennsylvania, about the work that they do and their perspectives on the Syrian refugee crisis. Hyatt and the NSC do incredible work every day, but it's important to note that the stated goal of 10,000 refugees pales in comparison with the 5 million total refugees from the conflict. The vast majorities of these displaced peoples end up in camps in neighboring Middle Eastern countries, with slim opportunities for further resettlement.
We accepted 10,000, which is a big increase from the previous year. This, of course, compares to 800,000 refugees that are seeking asylum, they're not yet refugees, that were admitted to Germany. So it's really a small number, and one of the reasons it's a small number has to do, I think, with the fear on the part of the American public because of the violence in the region and also the difficult political season we're in, where immigrants and refugees are looked on by some public leaders with disdain and are being scapegoated.
That's Judy Bernstein Baker. She's been the executive director at Hyatt, Pennsylvania for nearly 20 years. Hyatt is the oldest refugee resettlement agency in the country and works to integrate refugees into U.S. society by helping families secure housing, access public benefits, find employment, and become oriented in their new communities.
The work that Hyatt and similar organizations do all happens under the supervision of what's called the U.S. Resettlement Program, or USRP, which is run primarily by the Department of State. The federal program distributes funds for social services and legal assistance to 9 national organizations, including HIAS. These organizations are called affiliates, and they sponsor individual refugees who have entered into the resettlement program. But before a refugee gets sponsored by any affiliate, they must go through a nexus of international legal procedures that guide refugee resettlement.
For a perspective on the legal architecture of refugee resettlement, we spoke to Jonah Eaton, staff attorney at the Nationality Services Center, who assists refugee applicants and immigrants navigating the U.S. legal system. Jonah's work is only one part of the range of social services that his organization offers, many of which overlap with HIAS. Jonah sat down with us and explained the origins and complexities of refugee law.
The founding sort of documents behind this entire body of law is the 1951 Refugee Convention, which established an international definition of who was a refugee.
But for understanding the problems refugees face today, what the 1951 Convention did not establish is as important as what it did establish.
Refugee resettlement is not like an explicit requirement in the convention.
Right.
So the teeth of the convention speaks to if someone shows up in your country and meets the definition of a refugee, articles like 2 through 33 or something, or 34 of the convention sort of set down these rules of how do you treat this person. You think of the convention as being structured as who is a refugee, who meets this definition, and then what do you have to do for these people?
While the convention determined common legal definitions of refugee status and created standards for refugee treatment, it fell short of constructing an authoritative international body. Without such an institution, there is no international procedure for assigning responsibility for real refugee populations dispersed across the world today. Other UN conventions that do have international authority often have trouble with enforcement, but that's a different problem.
The Refugee Convention is kind of a funny convention in that it doesn't really have a treaty organization that was set up. I mean, so a lot of treaties, they'll set up various types of conferences of states, parties that'll check in from time to time and sort of monitor how well the treaty is being implemented. In some ways, the Refugee Convention was just kind of too early an international instrument to have that. More recent, international treaties usually include that.
So while the convention outlined who counts as a refugee and what kind of rights they should have wherever they arrive, it is lacking in several important respects. It's true that there is no enforcement mechanism. But even if one did exist, there is no explicit requirement in the convention that the international community take on responsibility for refugee populations. If this sort of requirement existed, refugee quotas for individual countries could be negotiated on an international scale. As it stands, refugee resettlement programs are largely voluntary, with each country determining quotas of its own accord.
An important and relevant distinction that the U.S. uses in its own refugee law is between people described as asylum seekers and people that are officially labeled refugees. Asylum seekers are displaced persons that are applying for legal permanent residence from within the U.S., where official refugees apply from abroad. We will go into more detail about the different challenges faced by these two groups in the next installment in this series. For now, it is important to understand that the 1951 Convention only establishes standards for the treatment of what the U.S. would call asylum seekers, those refugees who have found their way to a country on their own. The U.S. Refugee Resettlement Program, which sponsors refugees abroad for resettlement, is voluntary, as are similar programs around the world.
The 10,000 displaced Syrians that the U.S. has agreed to take this year are all officially refugees, not asylum seekers. These refugees will arrive in the U.S. sponsored by a USRP affiliate, which will offer financial support and a range of social services. They are also allowed to work immediately upon arrival. But in order to get into this program, refugees must go through an intensive background check, and they must be able to meet the UNHCR's legal definition of a refugee.
Earlier, Jonah mentioned that the 1951 Convention established the definition of a refugee. But what is this legal definition? First and foremost, to attain refugee status, you have to have already left your country of origin.
So if you're in Aleppo, you would have to leave Aleppo and go to a neighboring country, such as Turkey or Jordan, Egypt, sometimes it's not quite a neighboring country, Lebanon. And there, the person would present themselves to the UNHCR, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. And that is the agency that initially determines whether somebody is a legal refugee.
As per the 1951 Convention, the UN High Commission for Refugees defines a legal refugee on the basis of 5 criteria.
The legal standard for the refugee abroad is whether someone has a well-founded fear of persecution on account of their race, religion, national origin, political opinion, or membership in a social group.
After meeting this legal definition in the eyes of the UNHCR or another international organization, a refugee will go through a series of background checks related to security, a process which can last more than 2 years.
The UNHCR also starts the security check. They collect biometrics, and they actually, with Syrians, perform iris scans and compare them against data they have to make sure that the person they're classifying as a refugee is not a security risk.
So, if a refugee living in a camp outside of Syria is lucky enough to move quickly through the legal process, find a sponsorship match in the U.S., and pass through the UNHCR and State Department background checks, they will arrive in the U.S. with some financial, legal, and social support, facilitated by groups like the NSC and HIAS. But it's important to remember just how unlikely the scenario is, given the scale of the Syrian refugee crisis in comparison to the size of resettlement programs.
Every year, the Department of State consults with the UNHCR. Since there are so many refugees in the world, there's over 22 million outside their country of origin, and there's a total of 60 million refugees, including those displaced internally, but they're still within the country. But let's say there's 22 million refugees outside their country of origin. The United States will work with the United Nations, UNHCR, to determine which groups of refugees should get priority. And based on that consultation, they will establish basically a quota system and say, next year, due to the situation in the world, we're going to accept 20,000 people from the Middle East, 20,000 people from Africa, 5,000 from South America, and 3,000 from Europe. This is an example. So every year there's a quota of the number of refugees based on the continents, more or less.
These quotas are limited, and they're also subject to the whims of the political climate.
You know, there's only a certain number of sort of refugee visas available for any particular year. And basically just whoever's president gets to, list a number. Like the president has a very wide amount of discretion in coming up with both how many people are going to be admitted and then sort of, you know, can set priorities about where we're going to try to admit those people.
But as long as quotas remain small, most Syrian refugees will remain displaced. For many, the large refugee camps that line Syria's borders with Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan have become a semi-permanent home. Refugees are worried that they will be stuck in these transitional spaces, and they have good reason to be. There are several recent cases in which refugee camps like those growing around the Syrian border took decades to be resettled.
So, for example, a few years ago, the United States and the UNHCR made the decision that minorities from Burma or Myanmar who were in camps in Thailand were not being able to go back to Burma anytime soon or Myanmar. Many had been in the camps for 20 years, and there had been 20 years of back-and-forth negotiations to take back these minorities, which include Karen and Chin and other ethnic minorities of Burma, Myanmar. At that point, the UN and the U.S. and the other refugee nations of the world decided that they were going to offer a permanent resettlement option to refugees in the camps in Thailand.
Without a much more ambitious international resettlement program, the 5 million Syrians will continue finding ways to live at the edges of national borders and in gaps in international law. The refugees will mostly remain in countries bordering Syria, even as the conflict shows few signs of approaching an end. The policy changes that would be required to seriously reduce the population of displaced Syrians are huge and politically unpopular. Judy offered some ways to think about change in a system that seems so intransigent.
I think it's important we try to keep our refugee admission numbers in line with the needs of the world, because if we don't, I think that becomes a security issue, because then refugees fester in very dangerous situations. There's no alternative. And also countries like Germany that take in so many potential refugees wonder, well, what are we doing? Why do they have such a large number and we don't? I think it's a way of supporting our allies as well. So I take the opposite. So instead of refugees being security risk, I think refugees are an answer to security and make the world safer, because we're able to provide some stability from the violence. And I know that refugees are very, very heavily vetted. They're the most examined group of immigrants that come to the United States.
There's also the fact that most of the money going to support social services, job training, and education in resettlement ultimately comes from the federal government. In a sense, these programs can be thought of as a kind of economic stimulus for the towns and cities where refugees are resettled.
Oh, it's tremendous. Yeah, tremendous economic benefits. Actually, we did a survey, and I think this is an underestimation, but we did a survey last year of the money that's coming into the state of Pennsylvania through the refugee program. It's $26 million. And that didn't even cover all the different programs. And we create jobs. We create jobs not just for refugees, but for people who work with refugees. I mean, it's a social service field.
But there are also many who feel that refugees bring more than just economic wealth to their new community.
Most refugees send their children to public schools. And so the public schools start growing, and they also grow with multicultural understanding, and the children bring new perspectives. So in general, it's very helpful. It's difficult because they have to have English language classes. It's also a positive because it brings in new cultures, and also many of the children work really hard. They want to succeed, and their parents know that the only way they can succeed in the United States is through education.
All of this may seem like an idealistic way to talk about a very complicated and difficult problem, but the point that Judy makes here is important. Because there is no international body that assigns refugee quotas, the way that we think about refugee populations has the potential to impact their real opportunities for resettlement. If our journalistic project here goes beyond a dispassionate analysis of facts and figures, it is because this kind of thinking matters. The political pressure necessary to expand our quota system requires changes. Changes in the ways that we as a community talk about who refugees are, what they want, and what they need. Judy described the status quo as a political scapegoating of refugee populations. Jonah had his own way of talking about it.
We tend to have an idea in the West that, you know, they're all trying to, you know, sort of come into our sort of Western countries and I'm sure many of them would be perfectly happy to come here.
But this idea that most refugees are trying to come to Western countries is just not true.
You know, the vast majority, you know, anywhere in the world, whether you're talking about Syria or whether you're talking about kind of out of control violence in Central America, is that these people end up in neighboring countries and they sort of end up in camps. So the refugee resettlement system is sort of targeted at making sure you don't get these, you know, very long-term populations stuck in refugee camps for very long periods of time.
This point about where refugees are and where they stay is very important. In sheer numbers, the Syrian conflict has produced a massive amount of refugees. But as they circulate in print and digital media, these numbers tend to generate very alarmist ideas about refugees among Western audiences. By conceiving of refugee flows as this enormous mass of people, it is very easy to draw up racialized and fearful ideas about refugee resettlement. But a great majority of Syrian refugees are not headed for the so-called West anytime soon. For so many refugees, the experience of displacement is dominated not by constant movement, but by long periods of uncertain waiting, a waiting that over time becomes a kind of permanent dislocation. Because of the legal and institutional principles that organize international responses to refugee crises, refugees are stuck. Syrians who have left their country do not have a clear destination any more than they have a stable home.
Next, on Narrow Passages, we will look on a more individual basis at the challenges that refugees face as they navigate the system. Beyond and beneath the general problem of the size of resettlement programs, there are less visible ways in which different groups of refugees have very different kinds of opportunities. We will explore the real obstacles that affect who among the displaced Syrians actually have a chance at resettlement.
That's all for this week. I'm George Menz. Our show this week was written and produced by Leo Elliott and Isabel Christo. War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College. Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about our program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's warnewsradio.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter to keep up between shows and let us know what you think. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.